propaganda.
Alien race to come down and threaten us.
The military-industrial complex.
A highly funded yet unofficial government agency. Take the red pill.
If this were a dictatorship, it'd be a heck of a lot easier.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert, sitting in solo this morning as I finally get around to doing the promised upload of the interview with Mike Heiser. You'll be hearing that in just a few minutes. I had an interesting conversation with Mike about the theological underpinnings of the conflicts in the Middle East, based in part, at least, on the early chapters of his e-book, Islam and Armageddon. We only touched on it because the interview was conducted for the radio program that I do, which is a secular radio station, the Eagle 93.9 in Columbia, Missouri. And so while we talked to theology and religion, we didn't get into the prophetic aspects of the book, but I'll touch on that in just a little bit. First, I want to thank you for your patience while we have delayed the release of this particular show, but also want to let you know that Sharon and I have reached a decision that we simply cannot not do PID Radio. We just enjoy the setting and talking with each other. You know, frankly, she's my favorite person in the world to talk to. And so doing it in a way that, you know, basically captures the type of conversation that we have anyhow, which, thanks to your notes and emails and encouragement, has convinced us that we should continue to do this as long as humanly possible, and certainly it's within our power to do it. So we will have a program on Sunday evening. So while this one has been delayed, there will be a new program on Sunday night, and for the foreseeable future, at the very least one per week, and perhaps as opportunity allows, some special interviews as well, in addition to the weekly blather. So thank you very much again for your patience, and especially for your continued prayers and support. And so while, again, this one is late, you'll get a second one here in just a couple days as we do this again on Sunday night. Just a couple of things that I'll blather about here in the news while the topics are still hot. First of all, the ceasefire between Iran and Israel, or Iran and Israel. Did I say that? I meant Hezbollah and Israel. It's difficult to see from the way this agreement sits right now that Israel gets anything out of this. We're not even sure at this point why Israel chose to pursue the strategy that it did. The usual strategy employed, the tactics employed by the Israeli Defense Force in the past, has always been to hit with a lightning fast, almost commando-like strike against its enemies, to get the conflict over with quickly by using overwhelming force and the element of surprise. That's been a hallmark of the IDF for, well, almost 60 years. And it's contributed to the illusion, and I say illusion now because it's been shattered, that the IDF is an unbeatable, irresistible force. That has helped to shape the geopolitical reality of the Middle East today. No matter how badly its Arab neighbors wanted to see Israel defeated, they had to figure on any military conflict being won by Israel. This time, however, because Israel chose to use an American-style shock and awe air-type campaign, which I don't think is a coincidence. I don't think that's a surprise. I believe that the United States had a lot more to do with the military strategy employed by Israel in this conflict than the American government is going to admit. But because this shock and awe type of air campaign was employed rather than a lightning fast ground invasion against Hezbollah, while many of the missiles that Hezbollah had in its inventory have been destroyed, the net effect of this ceasefire is that Hezbollah fought the IDF to a draw. You can bet that many of the refugees coming back south of the Litani River in Lebanon right now are Hezbollah fighters. And Debka file indicates that many of their reinforced bunkers are still intact south of the Litani River. So what does this mean? Well, Hezbollah has done something that no Arab fighting force has done since Israel has been reconstituted as a nation state. They fought the IDF to a draw. Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah is becoming a pan-Arab hero, a messiah, if you will, that the Arab world hasn't seen since the days of Nasser in Egypt back in the 1960s. Muslims of all sects are lifting Nasrallah up as a hero. Now remember, Nasrallah is a Shiite. The Palestinians are primarily Sunni. The Shiites and the Sunnis hate each other only marginally less than they hate the Jews and Christians and Hindus and Buddhists and so forth. And you can see that by what's going on in Iraq. We'll talk about that in just a minute. However, Nasrallah, because he stood up to the Israelis and the Americans by extension, has become something of a hero to the rest of the world. Debka file has reported that Nasrallah's backers in Iran are not really happy with him. They believe that he's wasted something like $4 to $6 billion U.S. worth of missiles in a conflict over a couple of kidnapped soldiers. Which, incidentally, what's happened to those soldiers? I mean, this whole conflict was supposedly about getting those two soldiers back, and I've not heard anybody mention them for the last week. In fact, Sharon and I were talking about this last night. They're sort of like the MacGuffins of this whole conflict. Now, if you're not familiar with the term MacGuffin, it was coined by Alfred Hitchcock to describe something in a movie plot that was like the red herring. It was sort of like the reason for the action, but it really played no role itself in the action. For example, the Falcon in the Maltese Falcon was the MacGuffin. That was the reason that everybody was, you know, plotting and scheming and killing. But the Falcon itself didn't do anything. It was just the reason to see how these characters would react with one another. Well, that's the role played by these two, well, almost invisible Israeli soldiers now, who prompted this response and have now sort of dropped off the face of the earth. We've not heard a thing about them. The mullahs, the ayatollahs in Iran are upset, and in fact, according to Debka, had ordered Nasrallah to continue fighting for at least another 3 months as a prelude to what they see as an inevitable nuclear conflict with the United States and Israel. Well, that's disturbing. Of course, don't know what how accurate Debka's intelligence sources are. They do tend to be pretty well informed. But I think the fact that Nasrallah did, in fact, stop fighting is interesting, indicates that he is his own man, or believes he is anyway, and not bound by the dictates of the ayatollahs. So what the next step is, we don't know, but I'll say again, we believe that many of the refugees that are streaming back south in Lebanon to return home are in fact Hezbollah fighters. And so I don't expect to see this peace last for very long. In fact, we're frankly surprised that the ceasefire hasn't been broken already. And the next step in this ongoing low-level proxy war between the U.S. and Iran, Israel and Hezbollah, is most likely going to continue. Another interesting note, as of yesterday, which would have been August the 17th, ABC News was reporting that their sources believe North Korea is preparing for a nuclear test. I was a little surprised. I know that North Korea had declared itself a nuclear power last year, and I guess somewhere in the mix I had assumed that they had conducted a test at some point. That's not true. North Korea has tested its missiles, as you know, but they've not yet conducted a nuclear test. And according to the sources talking to ABC News yesterday, there is some suspicious movement at a suspected test site, and we may see an underground nuclear test in North Korea soon, if we've not already. This is interesting timing for Kim Jong-il, who had dropped out of sight in recent weeks, partly because we think of fear of international reprisal for those missile tests on July the 5th, but also because, possibly, a South Korean aid agency is reporting that there may be close to 55,000 dead and missing after a series of devastating floods in North Korea in mid-July. Now, news is from North Korea is very scarce. Almost all reporting about North Korea comes from outside North Korea. South Korean news agencies, Japanese news agencies. And again, this story is reported by an aid agency based in South Korea, which says their sources believe as many as 55,000 people may be dead and missing. A typhoon followed by several days of monsoon rains hit North Korea in the middle of July. And this agency believes that maybe 2.5 million people are now homeless in North Korea. Now, we think about the devastation that took place on the American Gulf Coast in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, devastation that, frankly, was worse than had a nuclear bomb been detonated at Ground Zero there. But we didn't lose 55,000 people. We do think the death toll is higher than what was officially reported, which last I saw was around 11 or 1,200 people, but not 55,000. This is really horrific, if true, and one wonders at the mental stability of a man whose nation has been hit a crushing blow and yet is still more concerned with proving to the rest of the world that he can play with the big boys by testing a nuclear weapon. A couple of other things. Also, another significant development yesterday, the 17th, a judge in Detroit, U.S. District Judge Anna Diggs Taylor, has struck down the warrantless wiretap program of the National Security Agency. I don't think we've seen the end of that story. This case will most likely be appealed. I predict it's going to wind up in the Supreme Court. It was interesting yesterday on my radio program. We got quite a few calls with emotions running high on both sides of the issue. And there were a fair number of people who said, look, if you don't have anything to hide, you shouldn't have to worry about what the NSA hears if they're listening in on your phone call. Well, while there is some truth to that, the truth is also that the Fourth Amendment to the United States Constitution says, and I quote, "The right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated, and no warrants shall issue but upon probable cause, supported by oath or affirmation, and particularly describing the place to be searched and the persons or things to be seized," end quote. In other words, the government is required by the Constitution to tell a judge why they need to listen in on your conversations and to present probable cause that you are a person of interest in a criminal investigation. This idea that if you have nothing to hide, it's okay for the government to listen in on you, stands this concept on its head. It basically says, no longer are we innocent until proven guilty in the United States. We are guilty until proven innocent. This is the argument that was given by Attorney General Gonzalez before a Senate subcommittee earlier this year, in which he argued that the key phrase in the Fourth Amendment is not warrant and probable cause, but the key phrase is unreasonable. In other words, this administration wants to prove, wants to show that they have the right to search or listen in on or surveil anyone in the United States as long as it's reasonable, as long as they can show that it's a reasonable search after the fact. The Fourth Amendment is designed to protect us by requiring the government to show that their search is reasonable before they do it. And what's disturbing to us is that there are a large percentage of the core Republican base, which translated means high percentage of professing evangelical Christians, who think that this is okay. Many of these same folks were very upset when similar measures were proposed during the Clinton administration. And frankly, I think this is a government power that doesn't pass the Hillary test, as we call it. Step back, be honest, Mr. Republican, Mrs. Republican. Would you feel comfortable with President Hillary having the power to listen in on your phone calls without a warrant? Let's take it a step further. If you have nothing to hide, would you feel comfortable with your neighbor watching in through your windows into your home at any hour of the day or night? Well, why not? Are you trying to hide something? You get the point. And we are seeing our government arguing that this Fourth Amendment of the Bill of Rights should no longer apply, and that we need to give it up because it's required that the government watch all of us, whether they have cause or not, in order to keep us safe. And while we don't doubt that there are people out there in the world who want to hurt us, want to do us harm, and we encourage you just to stay on top of some of the best and most informative analysis of the security situation. We encourage you to listen to the Homeland Security Weekly podcast, which is hosted by Doug Hagman of Northeast Intelligence Network. You can find it at homelandsecurityus.com. Also encourage you to read the website by Laura Mansfield, lauramansfield.com. Those two sources will actually get you better and quicker information than the mainstream media as far as what's happening in the war on terror. And in fact, it's turning out now that I just find things so compelling that they've written that Doug Hagman and Laura Mansfield are becoming regular guests on my radio program in Columbia, Missouri. There are people out there who want to hurt us, people who believe that they're serving their God by trying to kill us. So we are not naive in that respect. However, we do find it awfully convenient and timely that the London airline plot was foiled just at the time that real noise was starting to be made about the presidential signing statements and the power of the presidency exceeding his constitutional limits, and about this warrantless wiretap situation, coming to a head. This case in the U.S. District Court in Detroit was about to be ruled on. And you can bet that someone in the Justice Department had an idea of how that case was going to fall out. So we have those elements coming into play, and then suddenly we learn that it's unsafe to take a sport drink on an airline. In fact, day before yesterday, there was a story that came out that, it was only reported in an ABC News blog, I think, that U.S. authorities are not only advising airline travelers, to avoid bringing liquids on the plane because they could potentially contain explosive chemicals, but they're advising women not to wear gel-filled bras because they could contain those chemicals. Now, again, this is true. This could happen. It is possible. But we've reached a state now with airline travel. Well, with any travel that requires being around other passengers, frankly. I mean, if, you know, the gel in a padded bra could potentially contain explosives, why not my Dr. Scholl's inserts? Are you gelling? Yeah, boom. Frankly, I'm not inclined to fly anywhere anymore. Going to travel to California? Well, we'll just take a few extra days and we'll drive. Thank you very much. $3 a gallon gasoline? I don't care. But what's interesting, though, and what's key, is the fear factor that's introduced by all of these revelations. And the fear factor is what will convince many of our fellow countrymen, men and women, that the Fourth Amendment really is a dangerous and outdated rule and needs to be just ignored or removed from the Constitution altogether. So, other, there are plenty of other things in the news, but again, since we're going to do another show on Sunday, I won't try to jump too far ahead. One other quick note, and this is something that Sharon spotted and posted to Watcher magazine, and I have to say that as a daily source of news of importance to prepare for my program on the air, Watcher magazine is the first thing that I turn to, and she spotted an update to a story that we'd followed a couple of months back. You remember we'd talked about the test of a 700-ton ammonium nitrate fuel oil bomb called Divine Strake that was scheduled to take place on June 2nd, 6-2 of 2006. The test was delayed because of protests from people who were downwind. It was going to take place at a site in Nevada where many nuclear tests had been conducted back in the 50s. And the people downwind weren't happy about the potential of a bunch of radioactive dust being kicked 10,000 feet into the air, which was the predicted height of the dust plume and mushroom cloud from this test. And you remember we also pointed out that this 700-ton weapon was too big for any bomber in the American fleet. It would take basically 20 of the B-2 bombers to carry this much ANFO. It's been admitted since then that the government is trying to determine how big of a nuclear yield they need to destroy an underground bunker, which is disturbing because it indicates that we are continuing to develop nuclear weapons here in the United States. I guess it's okay for us because we're the good guys, but it's not all right for anyone else. Well, the latest development on this Divine Strake test is that it has been postponed indefinitely, but not canceled, and that the government is, in fact, looking at other potential test sites, one of which is White Sands, New Mexico, where Sharon's father worked back in the 1950s, by the way. The other potential site is a limestone quarry in Bedford, Indiana, which also has a personal connection. Sharon's from southern Indiana. Bedford, Indiana is about 70 miles south of Indianapolis, about 70 miles north of Louisville. So needless to say, people in Indiana are now concerned that the government is going to test this weapon there. So we'll keep an eye on this. And the Divine Strake test has not yet been canceled by the government, but could, in fact, wind up back home again in Indiana, as the old song goes. Week before last, I had the opportunity to talk with our friend Dr. Michael Heiser. Wanted to get a better understanding of the history of the animosity between Islam and Judaism. Have Muslims always believed that it was their right to possess and hold the Holy Land, and that the Jews had no right to return and claim it? Mike has an excellent ebook, a very scholarly work, as you would expect from Mike Heiser, which is available at his website. $8, a very reasonable price considering the meat that's in it. I'm going to need to print out a copy so I can make notes on it, called Islam and Armageddon. And it's an analysis of end time prophecy that takes into account the modern Muslim states. And his contention in the book is that the prophecies of Daniel, Ezekiel, John, that pertain to end times are primarily directed at the modern nations that are Islamic. It's an interesting take. Again, we only scratched the surface in the interview that we did for the Eagle 93.9 in Colombia. Why am I forgetting where we live? But interesting nonetheless in that he talks about the basic beliefs of Islam according to the Quran and how they have changed and morphed over the last 100 years. So, no further ado, Dr. Michael S. Heiser.
It's impossible to talk about what's happening in the Middle East without discussing religion. I mean, you can try, but you're not going to get very far because the basic issues are deeply ingrained, deeply held beliefs, and they go back a long, long time. Or at least, that's what we're led to believe. So, I thought, let's get somebody on who knows what he's talking about here. And to that end, we've got a fellow who's got an MA and a PhD in Hebrew Bible and Ancient Semitic Languages, an MA in Ancient History, with a specialty in ancient Syria, Palestine, and Egyptology. His academic interests are biblical archaeology and ancient Near Eastern religions, among other things. We welcome to our guest line, Dr. Michael S. Heiser. Mike, thanks for joining us this afternoon.
Hi, Derek. Thanks for having me.
We've been focusing on the geopolitical aspects of what's been happening in southern Lebanon over the last, well, almost a month now. Mm-hmm. And most of the discussion focuses on the tactical aspects of what does Israel do to make Hezbollah stop firing rockets, where's Hezbollah getting its rockets from, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But to really get an understanding of what's happening, I think, you need to discuss the religion and why these groups are fighting each other. Has Islam and Muslims always believed since the days of Muhammad that Israel, that the Jews had no right to Palestine?
No, they haven't always believed that. That's really an outgrowth of, you know, certain geopolitical events, of course, stemming, you know, right after World War II. But that is not, you know, that's not something you're going to read in the Quran. The Quran, you know, as most people are well aware of by now, has certain statements in it that vilify Jews and Christians. If you actually go back and read those, it's not that difficult to contextualize what's going on, you know, in the Quran. You know, the Christian Bible has the same thing, like James 4:4, don't you know that a friend of the world is the enemy of God? You know, and you know, it would be easy for someone to come along and rip that out of context and say, well, I guess, you know, Christians, if they think anybody's worldly, then they're the enemy of God, and then we need to, you know, expose these works of darkness and target people and so on and so forth. It's very easy to go back to the Quran and do that, and many Muslims have. But I think, you know, ignorantly so, because a lot of those things are really arise out of Muhammad's struggle against what he thought were polytheists. Christians would have qualified there because of their view of the Trinity. But, you know, you're never going to read something like, you know, Israel has no right to exist in the Quran. It's the violent statements are there, but they're selective, they're contextualized. And in fact, the Muslims even viewed Isaac as, you know, a special son. You know, I might be, you know, assuming a little bit too much on the part of your audience here. We could go back a little bit. There's a biblical story in Genesis that talks about how Abraham and Sarah were too old to have children, and God visited them one day physically and said, you know, by this time next year, Sarah, you're going to have a son. And she thinks it's funny because she's so old. And he says, no, I'm promising you this. It's going to be a supernatural birth. And so it was. I mean, she has Isaac, and Isaac becomes this chosen child who is the progenitor of the nation of Israel, the Jews. Well, the Muslims, you know, thought that that was Ishmael. And, you know, many of them do. But if you actually go look at the Quran, this episode with Abraham and Sarah is in the Quran, and Ishmael is never said to be the promised son. It's ambiguous in many cases, but in You know, there are actually some Muslim scholars that think it is Isaac and that Israel does have a right to exist, but that Ishmael, you know, as the progenitor of what we would think of today, not necessarily accurately as Muslims or Arabians, they have a promise of land out there too, a promise of blessing. And that's in the Quran and it's in the Hebrew Bible. Both Jew and Muslim have this in their scriptures. So this is not something that, you know, comes out of their holy books as far as denying the other a right to exist.
So have some Muslim scholars in recent years tried to claim that Ishmael was the favored son over Isaac, since the Arabs trace their lineage from Ishmael?
Right. It's really an appeal to primogeniture, which in Middle Eastern cultures, the firstborn son is the one who's supposed to inherit everything. And in the biblical story, Ishmael is the firstborn because he's not the offspring of Sarah. Abraham and Sarah, of course, could not conceive, as I just mentioned. And Sarah came up with the idea, well, why don't you just take my maidservant and, you know, have relations with her, and she'll give you a son, and maybe this will be the son, you know, that we're supposed to have. And if Abraham agrees, and he and the handmaiden, Hagar is her name, have a child, that child is Ishmael. But Abraham the patriarch, you know, by Middle Eastern culture, would have given the firstborn son, Ishmael, the right to inherit all the promises given to him. But God actually intervenes, again, in the Old Testament, and says, no, you know, this isn't what I want to happen. I will bless Ishmael. It's very clear. I'll make of Ishmael a great nation. But Isaac, you know, Isaac's going to be the special child. Ishmael is not the child I intended because he doesn't come from Sarah. And so the Muslims go back and say, all the promises of the land given by God, in their view, Allah, belong to us because Ishmael is the firstborn. And the Jews, on the other hand, say, no, they belong to us because Isaac was the offspring of Sarah. He is the special, the chosen child. And so you have these religious roots to this conflict. But neither one, you know, would say, you know, quote a passage out of their holy book that says the other doesn't have a right to exist and doesn't have a right to a homeland.
So where does that stem from? Where did this idea originate?
I think it stems from centuries and centuries of anti-Semitism, and really, you know, the same kind of emotion directed at Arab Muslims because of the Crusades, and then you have modern history, especially with the Palestinian conflict. But, you know, by the time that, you know, you get that situation developed after World War II, and Israel is just essentially handed this land that was populated by a people, not exclusively, but many of them were Muslim, you know, it takes on a new character. And quite frankly, Derek, I think most Muslims are like most people today who would claim to be, you know, Christians or even Jews. They don't have any idea what the Quran actually says. You know, the Bible is the Bible is one of these books that everybody talks about, but few people have read. And I think the same is true in the Muslim world. Most people don't know what the Quran says. They don't read it. They just listen to their imam, and their imam says, well, this is the way it is. And part of the theology, if you will, for many of them is just to hate Israel and deny them a homeland. And it's because of historically conditioned, you know, the historically conditioned atmosphere of it. But I think if a lot of them went back and looked, they would be as shocked as I was the first time I actually went back and read the Quran. And you find, you know, Isaac, you know, is in there, that Abraham is viewed very positively. Isaac, Sarah, most of these biblical characters viewed very positively. Jesus is very positively. Jesus is, in fact, supernaturally born, virgin born.
Really?
The Quran.
Really?
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I mean, you know, so a lot of people would say that, and, you know, there may be some truth to this. I don't know the literary history of the Quran. I know how the Muslims claim that the Quran came to be, but a lot of the content of the New Testament is just pulled right into the Quran and the Old Testament as well. You know, but the point is, you know, we're not making a comment about how we got the Quran. The point is that you have a lot of Jewish characters that are very favorably portrayed in the Quran, but most of these people just don't read it. I mean, I've taught courses where I had a room entirely, you know, this is not apocryphal, the honest truth. I had a room of 40 people at the University of Wisconsin in a summer class. They were all Jewish. And I had two of them ask me after class who Adam and Eve were. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And these are, I mean, they're Jewish. I mean, how could you not know this?
Well,
and it just shocked me.
As you point out, though, the level of ignorance of what's in the Bible is just as high among those who call themselves Christians here in America.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. Mike, what was Muhammad's feeling toward the Jewish people?
Well, he was an enemy of the Jewish people who, in his view, did not side with him against the pagans. When Muhammad originally, again, and allegedly received these visions and so on and so forth, one of the things that he was commissioned to do or felt moved to do was to rid his area of polytheists, of pagans. And, you know, he goes into the town in which he's living and says, boy, we got to get these guys out of here, and really starts to try to push, you know, these people out. And there were a number of Jews in this particular town who did not side with him. And it just freaked him out. I mean, it really angered him. And so this is sort of the genesis, if you will, of this antagonism between Muhammad and Jews. Now, you'll read in the Quran in various chapters where the Jews are vilified, and basically any of these Jews that don't, you know, essentially side, you know, with Muhammad's teaching and so on and so forth, are you know, to be either put to death or persecuted or something like that. But again, a lot of those passages, you know, I'm certainly clear, you know, that the Muslims, you know, many Muslims have taken these passages and just said, well, we need to get rid of all the Jews. Jews are called people of the book.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they are you know, referred to positively, but you know, it's the idea that they needed to you know, side with Muhammad, and they didn't. They were disloyal to God and that kind of thing. And so then the measure of loyalty becomes, you know, do you side with the teachings of Muhammad? And so this sort of evolves, and Jews are cast you know, as enemies as are Christians. But again, it never gets to the point where no Jew has a right, you know, to live or so on and so forth. I mean, that again, that's an application of what's in the Quran. It isn't necessarily that categorical. But you know, there are again these persecutory passages where Allah is the enemy of the unbeliever, and of course, the unbeliever, you know, can be defined in various ways. You know, the Quran does distinguish between Christian, Jew, and polytheist, and so some of these, you know, statements need to be contextualized that way as well.
So basically, Muhammad was reacting.
I would say it began as a reaction. He was very reactive against the Jews, and of course, then when he makes the Jews his enemy, then fellow Jews become his enemy, and you know, so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. It goes back and forth. But one of the real problems is after Muhammad is off the scene, his followers again antagonistic toward the Jews, you know, everything just escalates. And so, you know, it's one thing to go back and look at the original context for what Muhammad's doing and the Quran is doing. And, you know, I'm not excusing the violent rhetoric in the Quran. It's certainly there. But things are a lot worse now,
mm-hmm.
you know, than they were, you know, even then. I mean, when you get up to the Crusades, then we have these wars for the holy sites and you know, Islam, Muhammad's followers begin to make, you know, the cause of Islam something that is essentially mandatory, you know, for the whole world and so on and so forth. You have to realize Muslims don't just follow the Quran or don't just look to the Quran. They look to other writings of Muhammad, other traditions about Muhammad, other traditions that are, you know, written by, you know, followers of Muhammad. There's an accrued sort of body of literature. Christians tend to think of in terms of the 66 books of the Bible, and that's it. This isn't like that. There's the Quran, but then there's other stuff that is just as binding and just as important to a Muslim. And so, you know, something that's not in the Quran might actually be a tenet of Islam. And so, you know, we need to be careful about what says, you know, what source we cite for what.
We're talking to Dr. Michael S. Heiser about the religious underpinnings of the conflict taking place in the Middle East and the many conflicts that have taken place in the Middle East. When did Islam claim Jerusalem as a holy site?
Jerusalem as a holy site, it's pretty early. I mean, you're talking, very, very shortly after Muhammad's own time, because, again, this is, if you go to Jerusalem today, you have the Al-Aqsa Mosque,
mm-hmm.
Which is, again, considered to be on Mount Moriah, and this is the place where, in terms of the Old Testament, Abraham offered up Isaac as the chosen son, or was going to, commanded by God as a test of faith to offer up Isaac. Many, again, in terms of tradition, and there are hints of this, in Muslim holy literature, that the son that was the object of the test was actually Ishmael. And so since that happened in Jerusalem, on this place, then it becomes a holy site. It becomes a holy spot. So it's actually very ancient as far as, a place of pilgrimage for Muslims.
Well, now, was that the reason that Muslims believe that they need to hang on to Jerusalem and that it cannot become a Jewish city?
I think it's part of the reason. I think, again, part of it's historical because they did control the area at various times, basically the result of the Crusades and on up through into the modern era. They built, again, holy, structures in Jerusalem and, right there on the Temple Mount. So, I mean, there you can't just say that's the only reason. I think it's a fundamental reason why they want to hold on to the spot. But even if there's, even if you got somebody like Saddam Hussein, who's, for all intents and purposes, was a secular Muslim, his reasons might be as simple as we don't want to, have any sort of victory for the Jew. There's a whole spectrum of why we would not want to surrender an inch of the Holy Land, and you can't divorce religion from that. But that's not the only thing that's going on.
Would you say, based on your reading of the Quran, that the belief that Israel has no right to exist falls within or outside of the mainstream of historic Islamic teachings?
Well, it depends what period you're talking about. In terms of the Quran, the Quran claims that the promised people, the promised line goes through Ishmael, and so the land promised Abraham does belong to the Muslim. But that is different than saying that the Jew has no right to exist. The Jew can exist in the land, but the Jew can't claim that the land was promised to them. In other words, there would be a subservient, a subordinate, if you want to use that term, relationship as to who the land was actually promised to and who should control the land. The whole idea that the Jews shouldn't even be there is more modern than, the pages of the Quran.
More modern as, say, within the last 100 years or so?
Well, I would say certainly within the last 100 years, you probably could go back to the Middle Ages and find that sort of sympathy because, again, of what happens at the Crusades.
Mm.
But I think we're more secure in terms of Israel just existing as an entity, period. I think that kind of belligerence and hatred is really something much more modern. I mean, the Jews were going to be viewed as an inferior line, a subordinate line, and so on and so forth. They do not have a claim on the land and all that kind of thing. But again, that's different than just saying these people don't even have the right to exist.
No easy answer to this this conflict, is there?
No, not when it's as complex and as deep-seated. I think, our present administration, this isn't a comment, against the war, but I think if our present administration was really honest, I think they've just been taken back by the ferocity, the zealotry of actually, seeing these people willing to, frankly, violate the Quran. Because the Quran is against suicide. but actually violate the Quran in the name of Islam, in Iraq and other places. It's one thing to just read about that in history books, but to actually be sending troops and actually having to have the burden of solving this problem on your shoulders and seeing people behave this way, I think that's another thing altogether. I think it was underestimated.
Mike, sadly we've run out of time, but I certainly appreciate you shedding a little bit of light on the underpinnings of this conflict. Mike's website is Michael S. Heiser, that's Heiser.com, and you can find the electronic book Islam and Armageddon there. Mike, thanks again for being our guest.
Again, I'll encourage you to go to Mike's website, which is Michael S. Heiser, Heiser.com, and do invest $8 in Islam and Armageddon. It is a fresh look at end times prophecy and well worth considering. And I won't try to, speak for Mike here, but I'll say again that this interview only scratched the surface of the underlying beliefs of modern Islam. Suffice it to say that Mike's look at end time prophecy is not quite in accordance with premillennialism, amillennialism, but is drawn from his reading of the text based on the original languages, and challenges some of the basic assumptions, I think, that many of us hold about end-time prophecy. But it makes sense. I'm still only about three-quarters of the way through it, and as I said, I need to print a copy out so I can go back, study it further, and make notes in the margins so that I'm clear on what he's talking about. But it will challenge some of the beliefs many of us had. For example, he shows from linguistics in the original languages why Gog of Magog, for example, cannot possibly refer to Russia. Okay? So for those of us who are raised on Hal Lindsey, that kind of challenges some of our beliefs, but or what we thought was a proper analysis of the text. And Mike will show from the text in a very scholarly manner that that and other assumptions may need to be rethought. Again, we'll have another program on Sunday. As always, you're welcome to email us with your comments, questions, suggestions, bouquets and brickbats, radio@peeringinthedarkness.com. On Sunday, you'll get us both, Sharon and I, together, and we look forward to being back here in the bunker and conversing with one another and sharing some of our thoughts with you. Until then, I'm Derek Gilbert. Thank you for listening, PID Radio.
Gonna step up to the microphone, say it loud and clear. A better day is coming soon to get us out.
This is PID Radio.